I would like to talk a little bit about kids and their curious minds and the eternal problem of what makes serious mathematics. I think there is a huge disconnect between the two, and I would like to make some suggestions to think about. As you can see, I've prepared it very well. I have the official Danish colors on my first sheet, and on the second one, I have even your national pride Lego. And this is used by me with kids starting at the age of three. And the task for them is to, let's say, build a building of Lego or Duplo, doesn't matter which one, and then they have to copy that building with the other kind of stones. So, for instance, if we take the big one, that's Duplo, they are given Lego and have to copy the building. Now, the first question, of course, that kids ask is, what is copying? Because do they need the same colors is, of course, a question. Or do they need the same stones? You know, Lego has, as you can see in the blue one, bottom blue stone is three blocks wide, and then you have two blocks, you have one block, you have even a half block. So with that kind of questions, we just said, whatever you like, and they start building. Now you might think this is very interesting for 3 years old, which is. But if you do it with 12-year olds, they have serious problems also. And the same is for adults. You can try it at home if you like. It's so difficult for kids to do that we are actually now asking kids in two, pairs of two, if you make the big one as difficult as you can, and you ask your friend to copy it. That by itself is a very nice activity that you can do all ages between 3 and 12, maybe 13, 14, but our primary schools in the Netherlands end at 12. What do you see? Well, the first place, I hope you can imagine lots of opportunities for mathematical play, similarities, differences, scale, what is the scale between Duplo and Lego, and of course the enlargement from small to big gives rise to linear growth, quadratic growth, or if you want to paint the buildings, you need quadratic growth to take into account, or even cubic, and you will want to fill the buildings with sand or fluids. You can also talk about top, side, and front views of the buildings and about perspective, all starting with kids from 3 or 4. And don't tell me that they don't know anything about perspective, because they do. And on another occasion, actually tomorrow, I will try to show and prove that. You can ask your colleagues that have attended the meeting that it's really true. Now, to see how difficult that is, this, you can imagine, are Lego blocks. Avant Lego, this was actually an exercise that we developed in the Freudenthal Institute in the 80s. This is a front view and a side view, as you have guessed. And one of the interesting things is, when we asked it in our mathematical institute, it's long ago, so I can finally tell what the story is, many professors said, what is the front view and what is the side view? Now, that's a very embarrassing question, of course, but depends where you are. So there are two views that are relevant here, and no laughing allowed at professors, of course. Is how many blocks do you need? So we were a little bit perplexed, and we asked students of our best technological university in the Netherlands to think about this problem. They were 24 year old and had studied engineering and technology for 4 years. So we asked this. And one thing they agreed on was very easy. The maximum number of blocks or Lego blocks is 20. And of course you can see this if you look from the front or from the side, that indeed you get the picture we started with. But another problem is the minimum. The initial answer from the Delft students was 10. You can see the 10 here if you count. And if you imagine, you see two high blocks from the right side in the center and alternating from the arrow side. So it's still a good solution, 10. And we published the article in our mass education journal because we thought it very interesting that older students, engineers, had so much problems coming out with 20 and 10. After we published it, we got a letter from saying, well, Jan, you're a little bit not smart because you can build it with 9. And indeed, you could build it with 9. We got another letter, of course, a month later, you can build it with 8. And it's true, you can build it with 8. Next letter was 7, and the next letter was 6. So we are so embarrassed that this building gives, indeed, the proper front and side view. And then my question was to the mathematicians, why didn't we get another letter? Then that would be possible with 5. And they didn't say anything. You know, the more you ask professors, the less they say. What is this answer of a young kid? He says, well, I see 6 blocks, so it cannot be made with 5. I thought it was an interesting observation. So if you see how this is a serious mess, in my interpretation, but it's also for curious minds. The next one is easier, but also is about spatial orientation. This is also meant for kids around 5, 6, at most 7. I will certainly include 4-year-olds if you want. You see the coastline of an imaginary island. And on that coast, there is a church, there is a mill, and there is a lighthouse, as you can see. And the captain took 6 pictures when he was sailing along, but the pictures got mixed up. So you see the question coming from a mile distance, can you order the pictures as they were taken? And of course, there's more than one answer, but I'm not going to tell you how many. What we see in these examples, our philosophy a little bit. What we want is from informal to formal. I will come back on that everything later. From concrete to abstract. From the real world to the concept, mathematical concept. And the first examples were from spatial reasoning. So now I go to more algebraic reasoning. And we do that a little bit more in detail to make the message clearer, I hope. Maybe you know this problem. It's from about 15 years ago when the Freundel Institute collaborated with the University of Wisconsin on the middle school curriculum. Middle school in the United States is grade 7, 8, 9, 10. And you see a very simple problem, and the question is it a real problem or not? I would argue it's a not-so-real problem. The problem is you have 2 T-shirts and 2 Cokes are $44, and 1 T-shirt plus 3 Cokes is $30. Now, it's a little bit artificial, but also real for the students. And the price is, how much? The question is, how much does a T-shirt cost, how much does a drink, and of course, explain your answers, or better even, explain your thinking. Now let's look at a couple of answers from real kids. The first one, you see in the top row, he has identified a T-shirt and a Coke, but that's also in the second picture. You see that? So the argument is 1 T-shirt cost $18 because 1 T-shirt and 1 soda are 22, the first picture. They have 2 T-shirts plus 2 Coke, so 1 T-shirt plus 1 Coke is half of $44. Then you go to the next picture, knowing this. So what is there encircled is also 22, so you have for the Cokes $8 left. That is what we call reasoning. Is it mathematics? Some people might even say it's not mathematics. For me, this is real mathematical thinking. And I have another one of the same classroom. This one is even more, I think, original, creative. He or she, actually there was a she. She was doing it very visual. She said, in the first picture, I have 2, 2. In the second picture, I have 1, 3. So in the third picture, I have 0, 4. Is it a beautiful problem solving? So the third picture follows out of the first two. So for the prizes, we do the same. The first prize was 44. The second was 30. So now we have 16. Isn't it elegant? And how old are kids when they do this? In this case, they were about, let me not exaggerate, 7, 8. then they can already do it. Of course, this cannot come out of the blue sky. This is part of a curriculum, and the curriculum spends maybe 3-4 years before you are on the level that you want them to be. I have another solution that's maybe not so original, but it works also. It's a little similar to the one cup and one T-shirt, and comes out with the same answer. But what's so beautiful, that you have different, originally different solutions for the same problem. So now I can explain a little bit more easily to you, and a little bit in detail, what we think is happening here. You start with a problem. Maybe a little bit artificial, I agree completely, but that is for didactical purposes. You do some mathematization, you want to solve the problem, and we have seen already the three different solutions that are here in the middle of the screen. In order to reach that, the students have conceptually mathematized the problem. They were looking for the numbers, of course, because mathematics is about numbers, and how you could reason your way to a possible solution. What they didn't know, of course, at that age, was that they were actually preparing for real algebra, because the problem in the picture on top is the same as in the middle in algebraic notation. It's just 2x plus 2y is 44, and x plus 3y is 30. That's all. So kids in primary school actually did algebra, at least algebraic thinking. And now if the teacher can help over the years in having good interaction in the classroom between students, because they have different solutions, so you have a discussion over the solution, you have a discussion over the strategy, etc. How they make a schema, how they explain to each other how the reasoning works, and even formalize it a little bit, then you have an excellent example of what curious minds can do in real mathematics. So when you're in the concepts that are developed along these lines are the variable idea and an equation, so just to name two. And then comes the second part of mathematization, that you want to use your new mathematical ideas in a different setting. So you're going to use these equations in other problems, and that's called applied, at least, you know, that's our name for it, applied mathematization. And what does that do? That reinforces the concept. So it's a beautiful process if it works nicely, and therefore you need at least a couple of boundaries. You need good problems and you need good teachers. That's the only problem. The kids are excellent, don't worry, they can handle it. Now here you see the theoretical model. It looks very complex, that's intentionally, because otherwise it wouldn't be scientific enough. It goes from top to bottom. So you see in the top the real worlds, including in parentheses, not so real worlds, because if there is a benefit of having a not so real world for didactical reasons, we should do it. Then you go down and you find through conceptual mathematization some concepts in the middle rectangle. You apply those in the real world, and then you do the same thing and you get two benefits. You get benefits as in problem solving, and you get benefits as in getting better idea about the concepts that you are treating. Now let me give an example of applied mathematization that even was published in the New York Times. A long time ago, they had the same rather restricted, let me put it that way, ideas about what mathematics is. So I was stunned about this question. A string is wound symmetrically around a circular rod. You find them in toilets quite often. The string goes exactly 4 times around the rod. The circumference of the rod is 4 centimeters and the length is 12 centimeters. Find the length of the string. Show all your work. Now, this is for the New York Times at least a real problem, because you have never even thought about this kind of things happening in mathematics. That means it's real problem solving, because they've never seen it before. And they were struck by the solution. It's so simple. What you have to do is cut the roll in the length, open it, draw the string or whatever it is, and you see immediately that this is very simple Pythagoras. You get a couple of rectangle triangles, you got the standard numbers, 4 and 3, and you know that the length is 20 centimeters. So easy. So is the mathematics difficult? No, if you do this after Pythagoras, it's a no-brainer if you give him this picture. But it's a brainer, at least for the New York Times, if you pose that problem. And what was the heading of the article? They were surprised. Mathematics is thinking. Can you believe that, readers of the New York Times? They could not, of course. So that's one kind of applying your concepts, in this case Pythagoras, in a real-world problem that they don't know. More dramatic is the next example. Maybe you remember in January 1986, the space shuttle Challenger 13 exploded in mid-air after a couple of seconds. Of course, there was an extra drama because one of the participants in the rocket was a mathematics teacher. Even worse, a female mathematics teacher. So there were hundreds of kids, teachers on Cape Canaveral or Cape Kennedy, I don't know what the name was at that time, seeing something go wrong terribly. Afterwards, you can easily see in the left upper left photograph, you see in the red circle some smoke that shouldn't have been there. You see that in the photograph under that the flame near the arrow shouldn't have been there. So from the start, this has to be a drama. And the drama was so extremely predictable that it's still stunning right now. You see the right picture, you see that the long rockets on the side, they are called solid rocket motors because they have solid fuel, are built in 1, 2, 3, 4 parts because one would be too long. And between the parts are rubber seals. The evening before the launch, this fax was written to NASA. It is anonymous, as you can see. It's handwritten, and it is the evening before the launch. Why did the engineer write this? Because tomorrow it will be freezing cold, and he had concerns that that could be a problem. Temperature concern. So he wrote in his note, which was not very smart, but he at least had a feeling something was wrong, that you see the SRM on the bottom three lines, SRM 15, SRM 22, or SRM 25, were 15 and 22 were launches that had taken place at temperatures of around 50 to 75 degrees Fahrenheit. You see in the column O-ring, you see the entries 53 and 75. But below, tomorrow, it will be only 29 or 27, and that's freezing in America because this is Fahrenheit. So, when people started studying the disaster, his commentary was we should not launch under 53 degrees. That's hilarious because there were only two launches. One was 75, one was 53. And he said, if we don't go under 53, that's not really logical reasoning, but nevertheless, it will be safe. So we said, don't launch. And NASA said, you must be joking. Do we have to wait till April or so? Okay, so they launched. And these are the data from the little note. You see here the launches of past launches. And you see also that on the left, the point with the three, means severe damage to the O-rings that separate the several parts. But this does not give a real trend, does it? It's a cloud of something, points. But look at the table of the data that was found later. You see, this list is going from low to high. You see that, temperatures, from 53 to 81. But look at the right column, the damage. The lower the temperature, the higher the damage index. Do you know that? Well, the engineers and all the bright people at NASA didn't, or didn't want it. Because look, what happens to the graph that we had before if you extend all the launches. On the right side, you see the points that we saw before, and all the points where there was no damage at all. Those were deleted from the first graph. And tomorrow, we are going to launch at 30 degrees, and you see what you can expect, a disaster. Are kids smarter than NASA engineers? In a way, yes. This is data analysis of the highest kind and can be done with kids of 12, 13 or 40 years of age. The final example is from infamous PISA. Do you still participate in PISA? Or Okay, PISA, as you know, is about literacy. So literacy is, can you make your mathematics function in a real situation? Now, this is one of the popular items that was released about your heartbeat. For people who do some really cardiovascular training, they should take care that their heart rate at maximum should be 220 minus their age. That's a simple rule. So if you are 20, your maximum heart rate is 200. If you're 40, it has to be 180. But of course, medicine, research makes advances. Nowadays, there is a new rule that's called 208 minus 0.7 times your age. Now, the interesting question you don't have to ask, because kids will ask them if they're well prepared, what for difference does it make for the athlete? Well, this is the question, but the kids have the question. The question is, should you pose the question to the kids by themselves, so to say, or this is the PISA question? The PISA question says, a result of using the new formula instead of the old one is the recommended maximum number of heartbeats per minute for young people decreases slightly, and for old people, it increases slightly. So at my ripe age, I can allow a higher heart beat as in the former rate. Not that different, but nevertheless. Now the question is, from which point, of course, from which age does it make the difference? Now here you see the graph that the children should be able to make. Whether or not with use of technology, I don't know. This is made by a public available program that's called Desmos, that every child can have access to. And you see the two graphs. The red one is the old one, and the blue one is the new one. And I see that if you're 100, you get really 20 more heartbeats allowable than in the previous rule. So this is a nice example, I think, of problem solving, where most people will agree, yeah, this is real mathematics, and it's the real, real world. So the process of applied mathematization can be made very clearly. I finalize. In my opinion, we start in the real world, or almost real world. You've seen what that means. You do some conceptual mathematizing and the attached formalization and abstraction of concepts. So at this stage, you have a concept developed from the real world. Then you use it again, and you call that applied mathematization. And that has also the goal of reinforcing the concepts. You go back to that concept because by doing it, you learn. And you do problem solving. What is really lacking in school mathematics is exploration. We don't give the kids a time and reason to explore a little bit. And it's so important for your brain's executive functions. You have to play with an idea, and they don't get time and an opportunity to explore. We need more challenging problems. That's also excellent for the development of executive functions. We have to be careful in using context. If we use fake context, or as your famous Mogensny says, camouflage context, it's a disaster. Don't do that. It has to be real, the context. It has to be connected much wider to, you know, there is no geometry in algebra. It should be interconnected, intertwined, and also lots of science if that's possible. Children should be forced for reflection, and the reflection is much more effective than assessment, which, of course, in all schools and all countries is now in high regard. And if they do that, they test usually just reproduction and forget the higher order thinking skills. So, we need also the kids to work alone, in groups, and as a whole class. They need to use relevant IT, and that's a major problem. I can tell you, I just read an article this morning in a magazine about flying, that many more accidents happen because of automatization in the cockpit. I think, is that also true in education? And I think in a lot of cases it is. Kids and pilots don't think as much as they used to. More attention for brain science, and that's then the real end. This is very recent, as you can see, from 2016. And I just read the whole sentence and think about it. Importantly, executive functions may be developed in learning the mathematics in the context of challenging activities. Did we see that before? I think so. Not in exercising the mathematics once learned. I thank Gus Clements very much for this observation. And I think we should take it more serious than your government seems to do right now. Thank you.
Ja, velkommen tilbage fra foredraget fra Jan De Lange. And now we will have a discussion, Jan and I. And the first I will ask you, Jan, thank you for a beautiful speech, we call your methods from Freudenthal Institute's Realistic Mathematics Education. And you talk about it, but maybe it will be a good idea to define somehow what you mean about realistic.
That's a nasty question, because in the Institute we never agreed what it actually meant. Some people say it's realistic because it starts in the real world. But I think the official meaning is it has to be real for the student. So we have to engage the student with a real problem that they see as a real problem, and not what is usually that we see a problem for them. So that's, I think, the original meaning.
But you, when you see some of your exercises you use for teachers, it's in somehow handled in a way that, so it's not everything as a project, for example, when you make modeling. It's more a closed problem in the realistic world.
No. I mean, sometimes, if I'm incorrect, you just interrupt me. No, I think a problem, I like open problems, and I should also in assessment, there should be many more open problems. And in problem solving, it's even more complex because, in my opinion, again, a problem is only a problem if they have not seen it before, because otherwise you get imitation problems. At school, you don't see any problems at all, in my opinion. It's all closed. There are books with answers, there are answer sheets. And I think we are underserving, or actually provoking kids, and we do not serve the mathematics and the kids well. You know what I mean? I think both the mathematics deserves better, and the kids deserve much better. And the instrument that is there to help that happen is the teacher. So the teacher, he or she, is really crucial in helping develop the kids to their full potential. And full potential means also look a little bit wider than the mathematics curriculum as described by the government. I don't know if it answers your question, but yeah, I think it's a nice answer anyway.
Yeah, I know. Of course. We have a discussion about people talk, they make problem solving works. As I told you before broadcast, we have a guy, John Hattie, the researcher from Australia, who's talking about a list of what works.
Yeah.
And he have one of his points is problem-based education.
Yeah.
And you have some
Yeah, I think it's laughable. It's ridiculous. I mean, you see nowadays, I speak for the Netherlands, but it's a little bit similar here. I think you have 1,000 people that know everything about education. They call themselves educational consultants. And they all have their own theory and their own models. And, of course, problem-oriented or problem-whatever is very high on the list. But the whole idea is, and that I don't understand the seriousness of that book, no one knows what's underlying, what constitutes problem-oriented education. No one knows or have ever seen it in action in two places in the same way. It's a kind of an umbrella, and everyone, it's very trendy at the moment, you know, problem-oriented or whatever. Experiential learning is another one or so. But if you have no idea how it's executed, how can you measure the outcomes? You know, we did something in the United States a long time ago where the University of Wisconsin did an enormous study on the effect of a curriculum that we developed. And the outcome was, it only depends on the teacher. If the teacher believes in the material he's teaching, so he owns it, so to say, this is my philosophy for mathematics, then they outscored everything else. And what you see then, if a traditional teacher owns a traditional curriculum, he will score also high, but not as high as the other one. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But of course, it takes a lot more effort to teach a problem-oriented or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Eh? A more open curriculum than the closed ones. But it's, in my opinion, absolute nonsense, that list that I saw. Okay. Because if you get problem-oriented learning, what does it mean? There are many people that teach 18th century mathematics and they call it problem-oriented.
So when you recognize people making problem-based education, it's only a title, but the content is...
Where's the content? And how is it taught? Yeah. Are there 1,000 studies, you know, that are comparable, that are researched in the same sense in many different countries, with many different teachers at many different levels, that you can say these were all problem-oriented curricula? You know, if you ask me, is mathematics A in the Netherlands problem-oriented? I have no idea.
Okay.
We studied how the teachers are teaching it, and it goes from very traditional to very innovative.
But what you are telling me have some political results and somehow, because then you have to trust that the teacher can observe, and not we have a national testing and we have all kind of testing using around. Do you think there is a problem about getting the belief that the teacher is the right observer of doing the problem solving with the child?
That's very interesting. If I understand the question correctly, we have, of course, in the Netherlands follows everything bad from the United States. So we have testing everywhere. And the accountability is then used to say if a school is good or bad. But that's not what we should be doing. I mean, the whole idea is that kids grow in their development. Yeah? And that they learn to think what mathematics is and how you can use it. If you use assessment as we know it, you're not measuring what your goal should be. We are measuring something that our government thinks is right, which is completely, in my opinion, wrong. It's not real mathematics. It doesn't show any thinking. And it's measured with very poor tools. Is that the start of it?
Yeah. I think that's. But if you look around the school, parents and people who are deciding, it's not trusting the teachers observing.
So, no, teachers, so that's the problem, I think, they are really caught in the middle. No, I sympathize very much with the teachers. I say they should be paid much more, and that's not because I like teachers. No, it's they have the most difficult task ever now, especially at the primary level. Mm. In the Netherlands, when you're at secondary, you have a mathematics teacher, science teacher. That's a little easier. But imagine what a teacher need to know. A lot about the environment of the kids. You know, I hear all the time, Jan, they have to feel safe, right? Mm. They have to teach things that are very difficult to observe. Mm. So it's no wonder that there are simple assessment tools that they don't have to observe. They do it on the computer and that's it.
Yeah, yeah.
They need professionalization in observing. What I found out in a project for very young children, it's extremely difficult to ask the appropriate questions in challenging activities. Mm. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
That is so difficult. Mm. And then they also need to know either math or science, but preferably all of it.
Mm.
So how, you know, it's so difficult for teachers to survive in this mix of philosophical struggles. You know, one thing you have to direct, do everything first and then they follow, or behave, I try to let teachers behave like the children, you know what I mean? That they do the same activities on their level, and you get such surprising results. Include parents. I'm now trying to, I have a young parent academy, where I play with the kids and the parents together on scientific activities with toys, as in the school. Mm. So there is only one learning environment at home and school, and not completely separated realities, play at home, study at school.
Mm.
We need more.
Maybe. Yeah. I will have another theme to discuss. We got, as I told you before, this the competences Mogens Nisse's inspired by Mogens Nisse's thinking, this eight competences. And could you somehow compare making, mathematizing, and the competences? How do they relate somehow?
Well, the easy way out is very much, they are very much in relation with each other. Mathematization is the process from going to the real world to the mathematical world in the most simplest form. Modeling does more or less the same, but you end up with a model, and we try to end up with a concept.
Oh, yeah.
That's a little bit different. Yeah. I mean, but there's so much confusion, and that's the problem. If you look at on the internet at modeling, how many different models you find? You know, there are some are very simple problem, mathematizing, math world, solving, and back to the reality, checking your answer. That's the most simple one, has four steps. But of course, then the question is, what is modeling? Yeah, it is you see what I say? It's mathematizing the real world into a mathematical world. So they're very closely. I regret that there's some confusion. There are. Probably, I think Mogens has thought more about it than I do, because I want a simple thing for teachers to understand. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and I know.
But we talked a lot about
now.
It. We
it's
talked. Yeah, it's too complex.
Too complex. Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Okay. If you look at, I was starting about RME. Can you see a kind of development from when you started in the 70s, where it began as a thought, and now many years after, is there something direction? Is it going some direction? Is it still the same as it were?
It has never been the same.
No, of course.
It depends on whether you ask one person or the other person or the next
person.
Some
science.
But there were some things that were more or less the same, and were sometimes called differently. You know, one of the first persons, well, there are three or four persons that have invented realistic mathematics education. And some, you know, I came a little later, and because I was developing a curriculum, applied curriculum, I decided to have the conceptual and the applied part, but Treffer's used horizontal, going from the real world to mathematics, and vertical within mathematics. So there were many opinions. If you look at the books, there was, I think in 1986 or so, was a study in the Netherlands, how influential we had been with RME in primary schools. And it turned out very. I think some 70% of the books were, you could call realistic mathematics education. If you look now at the books, I think it's 100%. But it might be a little bit RME light. You know what I mean? A little bit watered down. So that's in the Netherlands, and no one is paying attention. There is no mass war anymore. You know, we had a mass war, of course, that back to the basics. Everyone is now more or less quiet. Our results on PISA go also very quietly down. But the main problem there, I think, is because it's not challenging. We discussed this before. In other countries, I know we have a very big project, a successful project in Indonesia. And we did certain things in other countries too. And I think in the United States, that's another story, but we look always at the United States. I think it's in Denmark, you know, I saw you. And that's one of the stupidest things you do, because they don't have any level in education. They have the best universities in the world, but the schools are just horrible. And on PISA, they are the last of all OECD countries, the very last. But nevertheless, if you get the chance to do something there, of course you take the chance, because you will 100% be sure that it will improve their level. You know what I mean? You cannot go lower.
So just do something, then something will happen.
So we had successes influencing the, let's say, the American view on this kind of developments. And recently, the last 6 years, I worked with this project for Pearson, the largest publisher in the world. And I think that curriculum has a lot of aspects of realistic mathematics curriculum and has, in at least certain districts, completely outperformed traditional books. So it's still moving. And at one country, it's accepted without any celebration, you know, because it's part of their... And other countries, they don't know what to do. I'm really surprised with the success in Indonesia. Sometimes I'm surprised with the United States that sometimes something really...
What about China?
Well, China is the next market. But, yeah, you need, if you look at all those studies, you know, Singapore, Hong Kong, number one, two. And the Netherlands is now, I think, 11 or 12. It used to be a one or two. But what's that, what does it mean?
Yeah, of course.
I have no idea.
Maybe also the cultural... thinking is a part of it. You have to translate it into your culture in some way.
Now, well, we once had a Japanese graduate student who says, yeah, we had to go to school twice per day. School till 2 o'clock and then school from 2 to 8 in the evening.
Something like that. a buzzword used in your thinking is guided reinvention. Could you use a few words about it?
Well, that's a Freudenthal word. It is that you reinvent a mathematical concept like variable or equation, but there are all kinds of things that prohibit you from going too far from the road. That's what I think is guided reinvention.
But isn't there something about the role of the teacher you have to be aware of?
Yeah, the teacher's task is not easy, because he has to take care, or she has to take care, that he isn't diverting too far to either direction. Stay on course.
Yeah, and maybe it's, I try to get into a discussion of why several teachers I speak with around in Denmark are a little bit aware of doing this, because it's unpredictable somehow. If you prepare at home and you want to make an information and you do it at the blackboard and afterwards they made the exercises, it's predictable somehow. Isn't there an issue for starting this kind of...
I always tell teachers, if you want to do realistic mathematics education, you're in for trouble.
You are?
In trouble.
In trouble, yeah.
It's the most difficult thing to try to do.
You have to see chaos in your eye.
But it can be so exciting. So to find the balance between your own curiosity in the kids and to see how
the desired outcome of the learning trajectory is, you know what I mean? Is he getting there? Is he getting there? And trying to steer a little bit, are you sure? And, you know, are you, it can be so much fun, but I agree it's very tricky and difficult. But there are some natural teachers who do it all the time. But to teach a teacher how to do real good mathematics education is very difficult, in my opinion.
But maybe it's a myth for some of the teachers who don't want to do this.
That
it's more challenging than in the real situation.
Well, the most convincing factor that I've seen are the kids. If you see,
they want to do it.
No, if you see the miracles happening in your classroom,
of course,
it's you know, I did we call them little bit mathematical project lessons. It doesn't matter what it is, but it's a series of lessons. And what we do there, I taught them myself, just to give an example. You don't even look at the curriculum. You look at the kids. You have some idea what we're going to do, and you let it go. So there is a knowledge cloud building that's completely autonomous. And there were teachers present observing the kids and me. And they were just flabbergasted. One of the remarks was, you know, we were doing Fibonacci, and the kids were counting over a million. And then one of the teachers said, Jan, they are not allowed to count over 20.
But they did.
Yeah, I mean, isn't that, you know what I mean?
And then
the parents were not complaining this time. They said, what is he doing? This sounds so interesting, what he is doing with my kids. And they asked for a parent afternoon. Can you imagine that they asked for it? And I treated them exactly the same as the kids. You know who did better? Yes, you know. The kids did much better. And the other interesting thing, I had 40 kids and I had 40 parents. Never seen it before. So it's not so that parents are not interested, but there has to be some excitement happening. You know what I mean? For their kids, that they come home. What we did today, can I tell you about it? That atmosphere, a little bit more of that would be wonderful.
Maybe I also hear that teachers are afraid of the parents because they are more traditional thinking about what good math skills are, to be quick in calculating and so on. And isn't there an issue to inform and discuss it with parents? Because I agree, I think it's a myth they don't want what they haven't been told.
Now, what we at one school did, and it's just one school, but it's an example that things really happen. The parents are part of the school in a content way. So what we do with the young children, the parents come play at the school with the teachers and the kids together. So they are at the same level. And the highest level are the kids, of course. And then, but that's so interesting because teacher and parent are talking to each other about the development of that young child. And we do it in the context of science, which includes mathematics. So, but that's difficult. But we did it for the lower grades, kids from 4 to 6. And more than 100 parents showed up, and there were only 200 kids at the school. And they spent a couple of Wednesday mornings over the year playing, learning, experiencing scientific investigations together. I'm not saying that that's possible for more schools, but at this school it worked, and they found it very worthwhile.
I often hear about low achievement, children with low achievement, that this is not for them because they can't do all this kind of problem solving. They have to make small, basic drilling because all the other things. I would like you to
reflect
give
on that,
it some words.
Well, it's very
not now because we have to. Kører vi videre?
Er vi den?
Vi optager. Nå, okay.
Men lad os lige tage den her igen, så hvis du gerne vil spørge.
Ja, det vil jeg gerne, fordi vi starter lige fra.
Vi bare ved med at optage, ikke?
another issue. I often hear teachers talk about children with low achievement, who have problem and struggle with math, and they have they tell me that it's too much work and too unpredictable work for these children to have this problem solving. It's for the middle group and the best group. Could you give it some words?
Yes, there are many different answers that are not very coherent, I warn you.
Yeah.
In the beginning, Deze was clear that low achievers and high achievers had problems. Because high achievers prefer abstract problems and not in context. They are not good in mathematizing. And for the low achievers, it was too complex because they had no idea what the question was.
Yeah, what's the question?
But on the other hand, and that's very strange, I've told you that I'm doing some research now for younger children, 3 to 6, and they are sometimes brilliant in their playing with object that I call scientific. Mm. So their level of reasoning is extremely high. But I'm thinking of two boys now, more precisely, but they fail completely at school. Mm-hmm. And I asked real professors from the discipline, so our theoretical physicist, Dijkgraaf, he is at Princeton, and our best logician, Hans van Bentum, who is in Japan now, to observe a couple of those kids using marble tracks.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And they said, I give those kids free study at my university or any other university of their choice when they are 16, 17, or 18. What happened in reality is that they both got lost in our system. They were just the most excellent achievers that you can imagine and are now low achievers. Uh-huh. So low achievers is low in the system.
Mm-hmm.
Does it mean?
And
high achievers the same. I got once in one of those projects, a extremely gifted student, they said.
Mm.
He failed miserably in the kind of things that I did.
Mm.
So I think it's extremely complex, and I cannot answer the question.
Oh, okay.
I just gave you some
something
to think about.
Think about things to discuss.
But I don't have a real answer, no.
I think I will give you many thanks for coming to Denmark.
Welcome.
And have this session. And jeg vil sige tak for i dag til alle jer. Vi vender tilbage senere på året med et nyt webinar.